Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Thank you for joining us in this, the latest edition of the OI's podcast series. My name is David Ledesma, and I'm Distinguished Research Fellow at the Institute. It's my great pleasure to be joined today by Hassan Musulmani. He's OIES Senior Research Fellow and Head of Carbon Management Research. And we're here today to discuss his contribution to the Oxford Energy Forum number 132 that was published in June 2022. And the title of his contribution was To Rent or to Buy, How the Big Real Estate Question Became Relevant in the Carbon Removals Market. Now, just to timestamp this recording in an ever-changing market, we are recording this podcast on the early afternoon of Monday, the 15th of August, 2022. Hassan, welcome to the OI's podcast series.
Hi, David. Glad to be here.
Well, Hassan, you know, there's been a recent discussion and hype around removal credits in the voluntary carbon market, as opposed to kind of traditional emission reducing or avoidance credits. So perhaps you could tell our listeners, what is the distinction between the two and why is the distinction so important?
To start off on a very high level, sort of an intro to voluntary carbon markets 101, credits are avoidance credits or removal credits. And the distinction between both is really that some are generated from avoidance projects, which, as the name entails, that avoids emissions from entering the atmosphere. Those include projects as renewable projects, for example, which substitute fossil fuel generated power, or conservation projects, which simply limit deforestation. So these are the most common credits that are available in the market. Around 80% of credits are avoidance ones. On the other side, we have removal projects, which actively remove CO2 out of the atmosphere. The difference from the first type, which is the avoidance credits, is that these ones would limit the flow of CO2 into the atmosphere. So when you're avoiding CO2 emissions, you're limiting the flow of CO2 into the atmosphere. In other words, we're saying that the current levels of CO2 in the atmosphere remain the same, while removals are actually taking out CO2, so they're reducing the stock of CO2, which exists in the atmosphere. Something that's worth mentioning here, that the latest IPCC report makes it very clear that we need both types of credits in order to limit climate change, and we can go into the details of the pros and cons in a little bit. But something that is personal, and I like to usually describe the need for both types of credits in a bit of an analogy, that is, if your bathtub is usually overflowing, it's not simply enough to mop the floor, but you also need to turn off the water tap.
Well, certainly in the UK at the moment, we're suffering from a real drought, so I hope that nobody's bathtub is overflowing at the moment. But moving back to kind of the issue of credit, you know, what are the implications, if any, does the distinction you've talked about have on climate targets or the claims which can be made by purchasing either type of credits?
That is a very timely question you ask, David. So basically, as a bit of a background, over the past 10 or 15 years, one term which has become very often used to describe companies or activities which offset carbon emissions is carbon neutral. To be carbon neutral basically means that a company would purchase carbon offsets from the market, very often made up of avoidance credits, as I mentioned, in order to compensate for its own emissions. So by definition, this means that the companies could continue to emit CO2, or even increase their emissions as long as they are investing in carbon avoidance projects somewhere else. These are companies usually that are present in developed countries and are investing in much cheaper projects or credits in developing countries. So as you can see, this can very clearly lead to claims of greenwashing. So very recently, this has changed due to more stringent climate targets. So the term carbon neutral was substituted with what we're referring to now as net zero. And it's very unfortunate that a lot of people confuse both of them, even high-level politicians, but they are very fundamentally different. So when we're talking about net zero, we're talking about removing, not only avoiding emissions, which are equivalent to those generated by your own operations. So if you're a company and you're doing everything possible to reduce your emissions, you're gonna end up with what's called residual emissions, those that you cannot avoid. And in order to offset those, you would go and invest in projects that remove CO2 so that eventually you are not putting any CO2 in the atmosphere, hence making you net zero. So that's the relevance of this to what I mentioned earlier about the types of credits, in that if you want to become net zero, you have to invest in removals rather than avoidance credits. So on a more general note, we can see that today we have a lot of initiatives and investments in carbon removals. You can see a lot of startup companies removing carbon, whether through biochar or direct air capture, which we'll talk about in a little bit. And perhaps the most famous of which is called Frontier. That is an initiative that's a collaboration between five technical giants, including Stripe, Meta, Alphabet, Shopify, and McKinsey & Co. And this initiative is committing close to $1 billion to those investments in removals.
Okay, so there's two types of removals that are frequently mentioned. There's nature-based, also called nature-based solutions, or NBS, and tech-based, also referred to as engineered. Perhaps can you tell us, you know, what are some of the examples of each, and you know, which one is better than the other?
That is very true. So on that, I have much to say. Removals come in very different forms. Some are nature-based, such as forestation or soil carbon sequestration. And others are what we refer to as tech-based, which rely on man-made solutions, such as direct air capture, or what I'll refer to moving forward as DAC technology. That is a technology that directly removes CO2 from the atmosphere and pumps it underground. And others are a hybrid of both. So those include bioenergy with carbon capture and storage. So you're producing energy from biomass, but you're also capturing the CO2 from that, making it a mix of nature-based and man-made. But because the distinction hasn't always been so clear-cut, especially with bioenergy with CCS, as I mentioned, the latest IPCC report has moved away from this categorization of nature-based versus tech-based into one of biological versus chemical in order to avoid confusions. So to focus on the pros and cons of each one of those, focusing on nature-based or biological solutions at the beginning, I'll take forestry as an example, so planting trees. They have many advantages, the most obvious of which is the fact that they're extremely cheap. So these projects or credits cost less than $5 per ton of CO2 removed, and also that the solutions are very highly scalable. So you can plant trees in most areas in the world, right? And the climate benefits are going to be exactly the same. The issue with these projects is that you're making assumptions about the total amount of CO2 that's being captured, because what you would do in this scenario is you would assume a certain type of trees and the climate performance factors that are existent in those areas. And then you would extrapolate those over a certain area. And then you would say, well, this many trees are removing this much tonnage of CO2. It's all an assumption, albeit based on scientific assumptions. But as opposed to this, the advantage of tech-based solutions, such as DAC, as I mentioned, or pumping CO2 into concrete, which is a new practice now, getting rid of CO2 inside the concrete, is that you can physically and accurately measure the CO2 that's being captured and sequestered within this process. So there's technologies available to get an exact measure of the CO2 that's being get rid of, but those solutions may not be highly scalable. For example, direct air capture is a technology that's very energy intensive, very water demanding. So those technologies might be limited to areas where those natural resources might be available, where you have renewable energy and probably on a coast. The tech-based credits also are extremely expensive. We're talking about somewhere between $200 to $1,000 per ton of CO2, as opposed to, as I mentioned before, $5 per ton for planting trees. So there's pros and cons to each one of those. But at the end of the day, there are a number of criteria that determine which type of credit is better. And again, this is also not so clear-cut. Some of these criteria include whether a project is additional. And this term of additional or additionality, it means it asks the question of whether it would the project would have happened without the support from the sale of carbon credits. In other words, are you selling carbon credits of a project that was going to take place anyway? And if the answer is yes, then that project is non-additional. So here we can see examples of tech-based solutions, which are fully supported by government. We're seeing projects in Iceland or the States, and they are selling credits from these projects, which might not be as additional. But also we have projects that are limiting forestation in the world, and those projects were going to take any place anyway. And so the credits generated might not lead to higher mitigation. And I'll end the question with this simple note. And the fact is that we're calling them carbon credits. And so if the focus was on carbon, then maybe tech-based solutions are much better suited to remove carbon, simply because, as I mentioned, we have more accurate measurements and probably higher permanence, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But they also come with a little to no co-benefits, while nature-based solutions such as forestation, they have a number of co-benefits to the environment in that they would enhance your biodiversity, they would lead to more resilient communities. So while each one of those has pros and cons, I personally think that we cannot claim that one is better than the other and that we need both moving forward.
Okay, now, Hassan, in your recent OAF article, you also make a kind of a buy or rent analogy to distinguish amongst temporary and permanent storage solutions. Could you perhaps elaborate on this concept for our listeners?
Indeed, David. So I make this analogy, and it's right there in the title of the article for a reason. So, and that is because carbon credits, whether they are avoidance or removals, historically have been viewed in two different dimensions. Those are the monetary and the physical. When I say monetary, I mean that when you go to buy a carbon credit, whether you're an individual or a company, you think of the price of the credit, and obviously you're going to lean towards buying the cheaper one. But you also look at the physical. So you look at what the technology is or what the solution is. And some people have a soft spot for probably renewables, or they have a softer spot for forestry projects or whatnot. So they might choose it based on the physical aspect of it. Also, in terms of scaling up of that technology. So we're talking about monetary and physical. But when you bring removals to the market, we are introducing a third dimension. That is the durability or permanence of carbon removal. The reason is each one of these removal solutions, they have different durability. One of them might remove CO2 for 5 years or 10 years. Some of others are removing them for hundreds or thousands of years. So that is a very important aspect of removals that, to be honest, is not being captured in the price of the carbon credit. The carbon credit is reported in terms of dollar per ton of CO2. So the monetary over the physical. So for removals, as I mentioned, this might change. This might vary vastly. So for forestry projects, we might be talking about 10 years of permanence. Whereas for direct air capture or any project that has a geological storage element, we're talking about thousands of years. So we need to create a certain metric or at least reflect that in the description of those credits in order to create sort of correlation between quality and permanence or permanence and cost. Another element here of time is not just how long the CO2 is being removed for, but how immediately are you removing the CO2. So in other words, when you're planting a tree today, you are actually removing the CO2 probably in 4 or 5 years once that tree has grown. But if you put a direct air capture technology in place today, that removal is instant. So there's those discrepancies which are not being captured by that price. And that's what this article calls for. So the buy or rent analogy really is if you are investing in a forestry carbon credit, it's more similar to you renting a climate benefit in that you're renting that climate benefit for 10 years. But then once that tree is being cut down, that CO2 is being put back into the atmosphere. And basically what you've done is you've delayed climate change or you've delayed the impact of those emissions in the atmosphere. If in the other sense, if you were to buy a direct air capture credit, then you're buying a climate benefit because that will last for thousands of years.
Okay, but does this mean that temporary storage solutions, are bad or unreliable then?
That's a very good question. I wouldn't say that they're bad or unreliable. I would say they're necessary, if anything, simply because direct air capture, while I'm talking highly of a technology like that or others, they're not really economically viable, number one. Number two, they're not very highly scalable, as I mentioned. Number three, they're extremely expensive. So they might not actually become a reality for at least another 5, 10, or 15 years. So in the meantime, we do need those solutions that offer the temporary storage solutions where you plant trees today, even if they're going to be cut down in 5 or 10 years, at least you're making an impact today. Because in the fight against climate change, we're actually in a fight against time. Everything is time relevant here. So first off, there's the immediate impact. There's the fact that they are a lot cheaper, as I mentioned. And probably the most important one is tech-based solutions are very much in short supply. So we're talking about an order of thousands of tons that are being now generated with direct air capture, as opposed to the billions of tons that we need to remove.
Hassan, can we turn the discussion for a few minutes to talk about measurement? Because in OIS's research, we've been talking about the importance of emissions and emissions reduction, that it's measurement that's vital. So are there any approaches to measuring the benefits of temporary storage options?
Well, David, there has been a lot of debate over how to measure those benefits of temporary storage options, because as I mentioned, the price of carbon credits is being reported in terms of dollar per ton of CO2. And as you hear from what I said, there's no indication of time whatsoever there. So a new measurement or a new metric that has been introduced is that of ton-year accounting. What that practice assumes implicitly is that if you store a short, small amount of CO2 for a long period of time, so let's say 1 ton of CO2 is being stored for 500 years, that is the same as storing 500 tons for 1 year. So they multiply the tonnage per year that is it's being stored. The issue here is that there has been a lot of criticism around this, simply because if you are storing 500 tons for 1 year, after 1 year, there's a risk of reversal. And so that 500 tons is going to end up in the atmosphere anyway. So what you've done is really just delay climate impact. And also, it's the fact that we don't know whether the climate benefits, which have been reaped within that 1 year, are enough to offset 499 years of them being in the atmosphere again. So it becomes a very complex practice, not to mention that it doesn't account for the impacts on the global carbon cycle and the capacity of the ocean and on the land to act as buffers or sinks. And I think, and this is a personal opinion, one of the biggest issues here is that it relies on a predetermined time horizon. So they measure climate impacts, for example, over 10 years or 100 years or over 1,000 years. And that time horizon is absolutely not a scientific decision. It's a very much policy decision. And the last bit is something I already touched upon, is it does not account for the timing of impacts. So it doesn't say whether the CO2 was removed today or whether it was removed in 5 years from now, because those two impacts are going to be very different, considering that global warming is increasing indeed.
Okay, Hassan, now in your recent OEF article, you also discussed two ways, that's vertical stacking and horizontal stacking, that the literature proposes for temporary storage solutions. So could you perhaps discuss these a bit further and maybe highlight any benefits or shortcomings of each?
Thanks, David. So I think this is a very hot topic right now. So those two methods, one of them is called vertical stacking and the other is horizontal stacking. So when we're talking about vertical stacking, that means if you were to buy forestry-generated carbon credits, then assuming that, let's say, it removes CO2 for 10 years and you want a permanence level of 1,000 years, then you have to buy 100 of those 10-year credits today in order to achieve a result of 1,000 years. But it's not as clear-cut as that, because as I mentioned, that means that those 100 tons that you remove today with 100 credits, those are going to be re-emitted into the atmosphere in 10 years' time, and the climate impacts are going to happen anyway. And that not only is that the issue, I would worry that there's a bit of a more philosophical issue here, in that when you are delaying emissions to the future, you are getting into issues of intergenerational equity, in that you're putting more pressure on future generations to clean up emissions that you've put into the atmosphere or that you've made the decision to put into the atmosphere later on. So that's on the vertical stacking bit. Horizontal stacking, as opposed to vertical, means that you purchase a credit today, and then you keep continuing to purchase credits as they expire over time. So let's say you buy a 50-year credit today, and you want a permanence of 1,000 years. That means you have to buy that credit every 50 years up until you reach the threshold of 1,000 years. The problem here is that we are talking about individuals and companies who may not be alive. We know they're not going to be alive over 1,000 years. So there's an issue of liability. And what if, you know, that company doesn't exist anymore? How would they address that? There's also the issue of the fact that the credit will change its prices over time. There's policy that's changing over time. And there's monitoring techniques that are changing over time. There's a lot of uncertainty around this approach. And I'll end with a simple example to show that, because a lot of people today are, you know, they prefer buying much cheaper credits, even if storage is temporary. But if you were to buy, let's say, this 50-year credit that I mentioned at $25, if you want to achieve 1,000-year permanence, then you're multiplying that by 20, right? 50 multiplied by 20 is 1,000, and the credit is $25. So you are paying 20 multiplied by 25. That's $500 per ton of CO2. And what I would like to say is a lot of the permanent storage options that we have available are a lot cheaper than that today. So you might as well just buy the permanent option rather than invest in multiple short-term ones.
I have to say, Hassan, that very simple example really brings home the whole issue of permanence that we've been discussing today on this podcast. Now, if I can move perhaps to our last question, because as our listeners know, I always like to end up on a podcast that perhaps looks into the future a bit. So can you perhaps share with us your expectations for the voluntary credit market?
Thanks, David. So I'm a very optimistic person. I would say that the VCM, the voluntary carbon market, had suffered from many setbacks in the past and criticisms, and perhaps rightly so. So there has been a lot of discussion about greenwashing, and from my previous research, I've found that there's very little to no correlation between quality and cost, and so that many companies, and I would give them the benefit of the doubt, I would say perhaps unknowingly, they did not question the quality of credits that they've been purchasing, and some have been accused of greenwashing. The good news is today we're moving towards much more stringent standards in project and credit verification. So you would see that the biggest verifiers in the world are becoming a lot more strict in what they would accept as a tradable credit, especially in terms of proving additionality of the projects, which I touched upon earlier. And there's also a number of rating agencies, I worked at one previously, which are closely working and monitoring these credits in the market. And they rate these credits on a number of a set of criteria. Additionality, whether the measurement is accurate, you know, whether permanence is good, whether there's any perverse incentives for the companies that are undertaking these projects. And many of them have been outspoken on many of these key issues, which is literally why you and I are having this discussion today. So in conclusion, I would say that I'm optimistic about the role that the voluntary carbon market will play in climate mitigation. I would say especially as it's become a key component of many corporate strategies, and the fact that ESG is now on top of the agendas of the largest companies around. So I hope that the next time both of us speak, whether on a podcast or otherwise, it'll be about all the progress that's being made in this space.
Hassan, I hope so too, but I have to say, I get a bit worried with the turmoil in the world at the moment, whether we can be that optimistic. But I love the optimism that you have, and thank you so much for your time today. And also, of course, your excellent contribution to the June 2022 Forum magazine. And also, just to let all our listeners know, Hassan is currently drafting a longer version of that OEF article as a standalone research paper, and that will be available on the OIES website later this year. I hope you've all enjoyed listening to this podcast. Thank you and goodbye to everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as all our written research, on our website, at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our oil, gas, electricity or China programmes, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.